supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we got one of them jam-packed shows for you cats and kittens. In the question of the week, we'll look at a topic we haven't really covered. Snails. Are they different than slugs? Are they tougher? Are they harmless? We'll take a look at these marauding mollusks. We'll also talk to the author of a new book who explains why so many American gardens are fashioned on the English style. It's for a reason you'd never anticipate. It's a lot to do, so we better hop right to your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Anne, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello.
Hello, Anne. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
Good, good, good. Where is Anne Fine, may I ask?
Hockessin, Delaware.
All right. What can we do for Anne in Hockessin?
I have poison ivy under my northern white pine trees and also growing up a couple of the pine trees, and I'm wondering what might be the best way to remove it and discourage it. And I had a tree company look at the poison ivy, and they suggested to weed whack down the poison ivy.
Oh, my goodness.
Under the tree.
No, you're kidding. They did not.
Yeah.
Oh, that would spread the allergenic oil all over the place. Whoever did the weed whacking would not only get it on their skin, it would be blown into them like little bullets. Burning the weed with a flame weeder would be even worse because the smoke is toxic. And a lot of people make the mistake of spraying it with herbicides, which is foolish because the dead plant still has all the allergenic oil. So people see it all browned up and dead looking and they just pull it with bare hands and then they go off to the hospital. Is this young poison ivy or is this a problem you've been ignoring for a while?
I've ignored it for probably 2 or 3 years.
Okay, good. So the vine going up the tree is not really severely woody yet. It's still kind of green.
Yes.
Okay, good. What we do when poison ivy grows up a tree is we get a very sharp tool and we get down where it's coming up out of the ground and we sever it. And then we wipe the tool down with cool water. Then you let the vine die. Poison ivy is an epiphyte. It's not a parasite. It will attach to trees and surfaces, but it takes no nutrition from them. So once you sever the vine where it leaves the ground, every part above that will die.
Yes.
And then in the fall, after it has lost some of its tenacity, you then cover yourself with protective clothing and you pull the vine down out of the tree. You roll it up into a plastic bag and then you throw away that clothing.
Right. Okay.
Now, for the ones that are in the ground, you want to soak the soil really well. Have a trash can next to you open. Have a big supply of plastic bags from like the mall and you slide a bag on each hand. You pull the vine very slowly from soaking wet soil till you get the roots. Then you just pull the bags down over top of the vine, throw it in the trash can or bag, get fresh bags, and move on to the next one. If you never reuse things like gloves or pruners, you don't pass the poison ivy around. Pulling poison ivy with gloves guarantees you'll get poison ivy for almost years to come because the oil penetrates into the glove. Pulling from wet soil is much easier than pulling from dry soil. And if you have a little accident, you think the poison ivy vine touched you anywhere, just have a hose nearby, get rid of the plastic bags, and then just using your bare hands, just wipe it down with cold water. You never use hot water. You never use alcohol. You never use soap. You never use a wash rag. It's been clearly shown that cool water alone dissolves the oil. And you got about 10 to 20 minutes from the time the vine touches your skin to where you can wash it off without any hint of a reaction. And then unfortunately, for the third part of your question, you'll never get rid of it because it is a native plant. It belongs here. It produces berries that are very attractive to birds in the fall. And the reason you have so much of it under this one tree is birds love to live in that tree. And when the birds have eaten a poison ivy berry and they're hanging out in the tree playing cards, watching TV, and then they decide to fly home, they lighten their load and they plant the poison ivy back under the tree. So the real answer is learn to recognize poison ivy early. It's easy peasy to pull the tiny little plants.
Okay.
The other bad news is everyone agrees now that climate change and the excessive CO2 in the atmosphere is making poison ivy more aggressive. It's growing faster. And there's now evidence that today's poison ivy is felt to be twice as powerful as that of 20 years ago.
Wow.
Good luck, Anne.
Thank you very much.
Take care.
Bye.
1-888-346-9499. Steve, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, Steve. How are you, sir?
I'm doing very well, thank you.
And where is Steve doing very well?
I'm located in Virgin Gorda in the British Virgin Islands.
Oh, and we're actually on the air, right? There's a broadcast station that plays our show.
That is correct.
Yeah, that's so great. Man, I love being in a tropical area like that. I wish I had to come down and do it personally every week. Where are you from originally, Steve?
Niagara Falls, New York.
Oh, so you escaped. You knotted the bed sheets out the window and got away to a beautiful climate.
That's right, a long time ago.
All right, good for Steve. What can we do for you, sir?
Well, I'm interested. I work compost, and I have a pit that I dig from one end to the next, and I'm wondering if I added worms to it that would make the process better and all that, and also the way I dig, would I be damaging the worms, and what kind of worms would I use?
Well, you are correct, first of all, to be composting in a pit as opposed to above ground. That is the correct style for really warm climates. What are you composting? What kind of materials do you have? Because I understand raw materials can be a problem down there.
Not dried leaves, because we have a lot of leaves dropping, neem trees mainly.
Oh, that's interesting.
And they're fine, but the green stuff for the nitrogen is very difficult to come by.
You must have coffee drinkers around, right?
Yeah, there's a couple of places I get coffee grounds, and I'm a pretty heavy coffee drinker, too.
That's one of the best sources of nitrogen, Steve. The coffee grounds are incredibly rich in nitrogen, surprisingly high in calcium, which is a great nutrient for plants. They got a little bit of phosphorus, a little bit of potassium, and the acidity they have really moves the composting process along. And you'd be combining them with neem leaves? The neem tree grows on your island?
Oh, very rapidly.
Well, you know, neem is like the source of one of the best organic pesticides. Neem has both anti-feeding properties. If the insects insist on still feeding, it kills them. And it's a tremendous antifungal that people use in neem oil form on their roses. I would imagine your compost is like super powerful, which you probably need because you have some bizarre insect pests down there.
We do.
So your compost is working so far, right? You are getting stuff that looks like nice black topsoil?
It is, but we don't have enough green stuff for nitrogen. That's another question I would ask is what would be good for adding nitrogen?
Oh, I think just the coffee grounds. When you read a lot of material on compost, it talks about colors. It talks about brown material and green material. And that's a kind of a shorthand that confuses some people. Even though coffee grounds are blackish brown, they qualify as one of the ultimate green materials. As would any barnyard manures. If anybody there is raising chickens, chicken manure mixed in with leaves, or if there's a horse around, some horse manure mixed in with leaves.
Okay, the leaves and the coffee grounds, you're saying we can get sheep manure.
Oh, that's excellent. Yes.
Okay.
And sheep manure, oddly enough, as you know, it's kind of pelletized when it comes out of the sheep, if you've ever seen it. And it's fairly gentle, and it is very well balanced. So that can be laid down next to the plants and covered with soil and used directly. That's one of the only manures that doesn't need to be composted first.
Okay, that's good.
That's an effective fertilizer. Now, I'm taking it because you don't see any worms in your compost pit, that there are no native worms on the island?
There were many years back, but they seem to have disappeared, and I haven't seen worms here in a long time.
I would not ever argue for importation of something like red worms, which are the worms that are used in indoor worm bins. When you're on an island, any introduced creature can quickly get out of control.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Mike.
All right. Very good to talk to you, Steve. You enjoy yourself down there, man.
Thank you very much, Mike.
Bye-bye. Well, it's time for me to take a little break and install some hope in the hearts of folks who now think that their Garden of Eden is destined to just be a Garden of Weeden. Studies show that gardeners who stay on top of their weed woes through the middle of August are over that unwanted plant hump and then can spend much less time on the task than those who've let things slide up to now. But don't go rolling down the window to scream, "You hear that, chickweed?" just yet. Because we'll be right back with more of your fabulous phone calls, why American gardens are British at heart, and what is a snail exactly? I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Verpi, a national supplier of seeds, plants, and bulbs, supports You Bet Your Garden and reminds growers that late summer and early fall are the time to plant garlic and spring bulbs and cool weather crops like salad greens and pansies. More information at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up, lots more of your fabulous phone calls and the difference between slugs and their relatives, the snails. But now it's time to examine why American gardens have an English influence. It's a very interesting story. It is time to welcome today's guest, Thomas J. Mickey, Professor Emeritus of Communication Studies at Bridgewater State University in Massachusetts, and more importantly for us today, author of a brand new book, America's Romance with the English Garden. Tom, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello, Mike. I'm very happy to be here.
We're very happy to have you here. Now, your book purports to be a history of America's fascination with the English garden, but as I read it, it's more of almost a guide to how to market things in America, or how the American garden, more accurately, was really marketed to the American gardener.
That's a good way to describe the book. My book focuses on the 19th century. The business of gardening then was run by very astute businessmen who came, most of them, from Great Britain, from Ireland, Scotland, and England. And when they came here, several of them were trained gardeners, and they had studied at the botanical gardens in Europe, and so they were quite interested in spreading horticulture, in letting people know how to garden. And so they were quite instrumental, not only in selling their seeds and their plants, but also instilling in the American customer base a sense of the English garden.
And I'm sure you're aware of the wonderful documentary work Andrea Wolfe has done with her books, The Brother Gardeners and The Founding Gardeners, about how even before and during the Revolutionary War, plants and seeds are flying between the continents at a record pace.
Certainly, that is part of my book, because that kind of sets the stage for the influence that the English had on American gardeners. But I think what makes my focus a little different here is that I'm looking at the business of selling seeds and plants. So when it came to that period of time, particularly from the middle 19th century, the owners were looking for an image or a feel for the garden that was very simple for people to understand. So it wasn't Italian, it wasn't French, it wasn't Dutch, it was the English garden that became the image in the illustrations in the catalogs. I was really, really impressed by how the introduction to the catalog, written of course by the owner, would be so personal. It would be his way of connecting with his readers, his customers. And he wanted them, above all, to succeed in gardening.
And when the catalog arrived, I get the sense that, well, first of all, getting mail was a big deal then. So this
was
a treat. But I get the impression that people were dying to hear how W. Attlee Burpee had been doing over the past year, how old man Shumway had been holding up, what was going on with their families and their dogs and stuff.
Before we had what we now call public relations, we had these businessmen who were really intent on establishing this relationship with their customers. Burpee, Mr. Vick, Mr. Henderson, Mr. Buse, these were all important nurserymen in the 19th century who had a following across the country.
And lot of that following, a lot of that mail came to Philadelphia, didn't it? I mean, Philadelphia seemed to have been a hotbed, or at least the Philadelphia area. I know Landreth was alleged, or is alleged, to be the very first seed company founded in America, right? And they're just out in Lancaster County.
Yes.
And everybody knows Burpee has a headquarters here at the old Ford Hook Farm.
Exactly. But the seed companies evolved, and some of them did move on. But I must say, in Philadelphia, there was a nurseryman, Thomas Meehan, who had a magazine for almost 35 years. And he was an important voice in gardening throughout the United States. What he said was more or less the Bible, because his magazine had been running for so long.
It was the personal relationship that people felt they had with these seedsmen that led them to try new things, try new varieties, and that in many cases, am I correct, that if you didn't have a family history of gardening, or you didn't have a gardener in the neighborhood, these guys taught you how to grow.
Exactly. They looked on themselves as educators, as people who would give you instruction. And they were quite specific about it. For example, how to create a lawn, how to take care of it, how to maintain perennials or annuals. I got to tell you a story about Mr. Meehan. Mr. Meehan, in his magazine, often said, "I bemoan the fact that our native plants are not respected here in this country." So that, for example, in England, there were gardens that people cultivated on their property called American Garden. And this garden contained native plants, like our rhodies, a black-eyed Susan, false blue indigo, those plants that the English loved. And eventually, by the end of the 19th century, they were becoming more acceptable to us.
So does this say something about the basic nature of humanity that Bartram probably couldn't do very well selling native plants to the new immigrants here in America, but England adopted our plants, and as you make the case in your book, we adopted the British style. Isn't that more like saying we all want something different, we all want what the other guy has or what seems exotic?
Yeah, that's a good way to describe it. We wanted what the English were growing, and if we had it, we really felt a certain status. But I must say that once the period of industrialization after 1850, 1870, after that period, gardening changed in quite a dramatic way because the catalogs could be printed so rapidly and chromolithography was introduced.
What was this like? Was this like a five-year period where you went from only receiving a few pieces of mail a year from dear friends or legal matters to where these explosions of color, I mean, like more than color TV, this was like unheard of. You mentioned chromolithography. I mean, people today don't understand that this was better printing than we can achieve today.
It was really beautiful. It was a wonderful experience. You can imagine people on a farm, most people lived on farms at that time, getting this catalog with a chromolithograph as a cover. Really beautiful art form. And I must say that the nurseries, for example, James Vick, not only sold seeds in his catalog, he also would offer people a chromolithograph of a vase of flowers from his seeds. If you bought 5 seed packets and wrote to him and sent a dollar, he would send you a chromolithograph, 18 inches by 22, and you could frame it and put it in your living room or your dining room. This was middle-class art. They were making people appreciate art. After 1870, the premiums, they were called, or in Vick's case, these chromolithographs, that they were offered as incentives, because by this time, there were so many companies, and there were so many catalogs being distributed all over the country. For example, Childs, who was from New York, in 1875, sent out 750 catalogs. Childs had a beautiful catalog, but by 1896, the number from his company alone were almost 1.5 million.
That's just astounding.
And because of printing and free mail delivery, rural mail delivery, people would bring the catalog right to your door. And so this was really the first media form, mass media form. As I looked at the covers of those catalogs from after 1875, 1880, the covers tended to be quite similar. They always had a lawn, an extensive lawn from the house with a curved walkway with groups of flowering shrubs, perhaps 3 in the group, a bed of flowers on the lawn, and then trees to line the property. And Tom Carter, who's an English historian, said those are the elements of the English garden in the 19th century. So in that sense, all these catalogs were selling through their imagery first this English garden design.
Right. You make the case in your book. And of course, I've tried to explain to our listeners for 14 years now, that all the grasses we grow, the majority of them, certainly on the East Coast, the cold weather regions, are all from England, Scotland, Ireland, and Wales. The lawn is a, quote, British invention. Now, were these catalogs selling actual grass seed, or was the lawn just there to show how the finished product should look?
Well, they were doing both. They often had images, illustrations on the cover and inside, but almost all of them also sold grass seed, and they would recommend the amount to use for your grass because they were quite emphatic about having the lawn. The lawn was the essence of the landscape or the garden. You had to have a lawn, which was really attractive, especially when suburbs developed after 1870. That was a feature that real estate agents used. They said, now you can have a lawn at your new home.
Tom, I could go through my email files and create an overloaded folder called Lawn Shame, where people are writing in, I have to get rid of this weed, or I have to do something because my neighbors are giving me the hairy eye every day. And it all goes back to America's romance with English gardens. Thomas J. Mickey is author of the new book, America's Romance with the English Garden. It is published by the Ohio University Press. Tom, thanks for spending some time with us today on You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you, Mike. I enjoyed it. Thank you.
And now back to your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Celeste, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
How are you?
Good, good, Celeste. How are you doing?
I'm fine, thank you. It's been hot up here, and I got lots of questions for you, Mike.
Okay, where is up there?
I am up in Stamford, Connecticut. You might remember me from my old Obex days.
Oh, yes, I do. Celeste, you made that fabulous Nova wood. You took these plastic bags and trash plastic that other people said was totally unrecyclable, and you recycled it into this great plastic lumber that made some of the best raised bed frames. I am proud to say that I still have a 4x4 raised bed kit in my garden that looks brand new that I got from you sometime in the 1990s.
Yes, they have all survived incredibly well. In fact, my husband and I went to a house that someone wanted him to do some work on, and there in the backyard was one of our compost bins, and I asked the person if they wanted it, and they said, yes, we'd actually like you to put it back together again. We want to keep using it. So here we are almost three decades later, still having the same unit available and working with no problems.
What can we do for my old friend Celeste up in Connecticut?
The curiosity that I have is that it seems to be that when you do not keep the pH high enough under trees like Japanese maples, for example, or large oaks, that the grass underneath those trees tends to wither and disappear, whereas if you can keep the pH up, that the grass will continue to stick around. Is that my imagination?
No. There are certain situations where it's almost literally impossible to grow grass under trees due to both the shade that the tree casts and to the intense competition for water and nutrients. But in many situations, especially when the trees are, quote, specimens, they're standing alone and can still get some sun from all sides and there's a lot of nutrients around, some people can grow grass right up to the trunk. But you are correct. One of the limiting factors for lawn grasses, especially in high rainfall areas, is the soil pH. Your soil is always going to naturally tend to try to be acidic, and your lawn wants it to be neutral. So especially if you've noticed your pH dropping below 6.5, adding lime or wood ash. I would think wood ash would be highly abundant in Connecticut, and it's a great way to raise soil pH. If that does it and the grass then thrives, I think you figured it out. I think that's all that your lawn needed to get over that last hump was to be growing in a perfect pH.
But is it possible that because of the nature of the leaves, the oils off the leaves when it rains also creates part of that problem?
No.
Is it purely a soil-based, ground-based dilemma?
It's something that is poorly understood by me, but it has to do tremendously with rainfall. Areas that get a lot of rain have acid soil. Areas that have long periods of drought tend to have very alkaline soils. As you go out west and you get into areas of low rainfall, some of the soils are so alkaline it blows your mind. I mean, the numbers are up in the nines. You know, nothing grows there until you tremendously modify the pH. And it's much easier to bring the pH up here in the north with lime or wood ash than it is to recover from alkalinity out west. It's very difficult. But there, it doesn't have anything to do with the trees or the leaves. It has some to do with acid rain, but largely I'm led to believe it has to do with the total amount of rain. The more rain you get, the more acidic your soils are going to tend to be.
That's a very interesting dynamic. Then the last question I have is relative to the wood ash. I thought wood ash was highly acidic.
No, just the opposite. Wood ash is alkaline, and there's a real easy formula you can use. Wood ash is two-thirds as alkaline as calcium carbonate, as agricultural lime. So if you get a soil test that says to spread 100 pounds of lime, you spread 133 pounds of wood ash, you get the same amount of calcium, plus you get a lot of trace nutrients that are not in the lime, and of course you help somebody get rid of their wood ash.
Fascinating.
And you know, out where you are, there's tons of fireplaces and wood stoves.
Yes, especially after all the trees that came down after Sandy and all the the other storms that we've had. So.
Same here, honey. Ain't nobody been buying firewood the last 2 years.
Well, I don't want to keep you. It's been wonderful to talk with you. I just figured I got to call and say hi.
Oh, and I'm so glad you did. I have such fond memories, and I hope someone hears our conversation and is inspired to create the kind of wonderful recycled plastic lumber you once made. It was just a fabulous, fabulous product, and I remember you being a wonderful person.
Why, thank you, Mike. Bye, Mike.
Bye-bye. Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind everybody going through dry times that the best and least expensive way to water is deeply and infrequently, preferably at the base of the plants and always early in the morning. Short sprinkles don't give your plants enough time to take up water. Plants are closed up tight and resist moisture during the heat of the day. And watering in the evening encourages disease. But don't go hiding the hose from your husband just yet, because we'll be right back with lots more of your fabulous phone calls and the story on the slug that carries a house upon its back. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Burpee supports You Bet Your Garden and reminds growers that summer is the time to obtain garlic and spring bulbs for planting in the fall, as well as seeds for fall crops of pansies, salad green seeds, and other cool weather lovers. Learn more at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up in just a little bit, we will have the question of the week. Are snails just slugs in disguise, something different, something harmless? We'll tell you all about it after a couple more of your fascinating phone calls. And 1-888-346-9499. Brian, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
How are you?
I'm doing good, Bri. How are you, sir?
I'm doing quite well, thank you.
And where does Brian do well?
I am in the Washington Square West neighborhood of Center City, Philadelphia.
Oh, really? What a delightful neighborhood. And one of the four original squares of Philadelphia. And one thing, I'm now going to reveal something that no one knows who listens to this show. In the 1960s, during my last year of high school and my first year of college, I was a store detective at Gimbel's Department Store at 8th and Market. And I used to go down to Washington Square to eat my lunch. It's a big public park. And realized one day I found this old obscured monument that was covered with trash and leaves, and then was just stunned that the whole Washington Square is a burial ground for heroes of the Revolutionary War. All these tinkers and traders and farmers and tinsmith and silversmith who died fighting for our independence. Hundreds of them are buried down there.
I did not know that.
And they've cleaned it up, and it's my understanding there's an eternal flame and a plaque and a monument to them now. But I've always looked at the city differently since I saw that old monument. So, now that I've blown you away, Brian, what can we do for Brian in Washington Square?
So, I have a little patch of garden that's maybe 4 feet by 1 feet, and it's in essentially a walled-off alleyway,
right.
And it's a bit subterranean, so maybe from the sidewalk it's down about 6 to 10 feet. So it gets indirect light, if any. In addition to it getting barely any sunlight, it's also extremely damp down there. It
you
seems
think?
That everyone's air conditioner compressors seem to unload into a gutter that drains into the far corner of this little depth.
Mm-hmm.
And on top of that, my duct from my dryer, when that runs, all of the moist, hot air comes out into there. So it's essentially a Thailand jungle in there. And then there's one more problematic thing. The soil is probably pretty terrible because the original inhabitants of this apartment seem to think it was basically a trash can. I found cigarette butts, bottle caps, pieces of glass, papers, and plastics, you name it. I probably found it in there. So I cleaned it out to the best of my ability, and I planted a few things that aren't looking the best right now, but I was hoping maybe you could help me out and maybe spruce it up a bit better.
Do people call you Uncle Fester? I mean, this is like the Adams Family garden you've got here. Well, obviously, this is not the ideal place. What's your goal? Because if you really want to grow things, you know to join a community garden somewhere nearby. There's some really nice community gardens in your area.
Oh, definitely. I mean, I just want to fill it up with things that are pleasant to look at, but not things that I'm going to do a disservice to. So right now I have a foxglove in there.
Mm-hmm.
I have a Japanese fern.
The fern is probably doing okay.
So far, I only put it in the ground 2 days ago.
Okay. With you being in Center City and really in the heart of Center City, there's really no point in you trying to grow anything in what could be really contaminated ground, in addition to whatever feral animals and feral humans have done back there. There's a strong possibility of lead paint being in the soil. And that's a risk for you to be working with, unless you're wearing gloves and stuff, which I hope you have been.
No. That's going to be something I'll remedy.
Yes, yes. You should wear gloves whenever you work in any kind of these Atlantean soils from the 13th century. What I would do if I were you, and I really wanted to do something back there, is because it already is moist, I might lean into it and put a little fountain against a wall and have that like living thing of the running water going back and forth. That might be fun. You might get some butterflies and some birds coming in. And then I would take a look at some really nice containers or even building containers out of bricks or Belgian block and filling those with something nice. And then putting in the most shade-tolerant plants known to man. But I wouldn't try to grow in the ground. I would get some nice containers or build some nice planting things, go out and buy some nice compost or topsoil. And then you'll have a real good thing going out there. And I would really consider that fountain, leaning in into the dampness to get that nice sound out there and maybe, like I said, bring in a little bit of bird or butterfly and brighten up the place.
Yeah, hopefully. Okay, that sounds great.
All right, man?
All right, thanks for all the tips.
All right, good luck.
Thank you. You take care.
1-888-346-9499. Julianne, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. How are you?
I am doing just fine, Julianne. How are you?
I'm great. Love the show.
Well, thank you very much. May I call you Julie?
Yes.
And where is Julie?
I am in the Lehigh Valley in Pennsylvania in a little town called Breinigsville.
Breinigsville. My son used to play baseball in Breinigsville.
Cool.
What can we do for Julie in Breinigsville?
So my husband and I bought a new construction home, and it has very little landscaping. We did add some mulch and some topsoil to new beds that we created, and suddenly I have 4 or 5 inch pink, salmon pink mushrooms growing only on one bed that is actually connected to 2 other beds, but I don't know what to do with them because every time I remove them, the mulch underneath is powdery white, and there are roots that look like they're connected to white balls.
Not quite roots. The white stuff is called mycelium, and in the world of the gray, it is the equivalent of the root of a plant in the world of the mushroom. It sounds like they're the stinkhorn mushroom. This is one of the many casualties of trashy wood mulch. I know you see it everywhere. But, and I don't know how old you are, but when I was growing up in the 50s and 60s, everybody smoked cigarettes. And of course, we now know that everybody was wrong. Today, everybody spreads wood mulch around the property, and everyone is wrong. There is no horticultural reason to do this. And one of the problems is this fails to take into account anything about the nature of wood in the environment. Because if you go through the woods, yes, trees fall down and branches fall down, and you often see mushrooms sprouting off of these fallen trees and stuff. But Mother Nature does not spread this mulch around everywhere. One of the big jobs of fungal organisms, and there are literally billions of species of fungal organisms in the air that we breathe, one of the main jobs of a large subspecies is to return wood to the soil, is to accelerate the breakdown. So that's what you have are called nuisance molds, and it sounds like you have 2 or 3 different kinds of nuisance molds. And these are fungi that are ubiquitous in the environment. They're latching on to your wood, and they are using the nutrients in the wood to grow big mushrooms and at the same time accelerating the decomposition of the wood.
Of my mulch, Mike?
Yeah. Because it was never a good idea to spread this stuff around our homes. So
right.
The answer is to rake up as much of the wood mulch as you can. And then go out in the Lehigh Valley. You have access to great municipal compost. You have access to great mushroom soil. If you're going to get mushroom soil, make sure it's aged so it doesn't have any smell anymore. Or get nice municipal compost from one of the big compost sites near you. And use that as your mulch instead. It'll be nice and rich and black. It'll feed your plants as opposed to stealing food from them, which is another thing the wood mulch is doing. And it won't breed any of these nuisance molds.
So I've been wasting my time by going out to dig them up
you know, because they're essentially still in that mulch.
Oh, the spores. There's billions of spores in the mulch. No, you've not been wasting your time. There's been some nice weather. It kept you out of the pool room and off the street corner with those bad companions. No. Actually, I shouldn't joke. You need to be careful whenever you have strange fungal material growing in mulch. You should probably wear a dust mask. And there's really no reason to try to remove the individual mushrooms. There's millions more where that came from. And they won't stop as long as the wood looks like wood.
Okay. Great. Right. I guess my husband and I are not quite done our landscaping activities for the year.
A homeowner is never done. It's the ethic of constant improvement.
Yep.
All right. Good luck, Jewel.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye, Mike.
All right. As promised, it's time for the question of the week. Are snails just slugs wearing mobile homes? You Bet Your Garden producer Alexis Landis, please read us this week's intriguing question.
Sure, Mike. We heard from Marjorie in Wissahickon. Marjorie writes, can you discuss the snails that seem to have become part of the landscape in the Philadelphia area? This spring, they seem to outnumber slugs. Are they harmful? Slugs in disguise? Please tell us. Thank you.
Well, Marge, the bottom line is that snails are essentially the same type of creature as the slimy slug, although I wouldn't call their shell a disguise. It's more the result of a certain mineral being abundant or absent. Both snails and slugs are mollusks, a large category of invertebrates that also includes octopus and squid. Both move around by means of a single muscular foot, leave trails of slime, have a body part called a mantle on top of their back, are hermaphrodites, and at least the species that live on land can consume lots of plant material. The shell that forms on the mantle of a snail is made of absorbed calcium, so you'll find fewer snails in areas with calcium-poor soils and lots of snails where calcium is abundant.
And the snail's shell is there for protection, right?
Yes and no. One of the main purposes of the snail shell seems to be moisture conservation. Mollusks dry out easily, and a shell, especially one that the creature can fully retract into, is a really good way to stay moist. But that shell is attached, meaning that slugs, even the big ones, can slither into much smaller spaces to escape predators and/or stay moist. Slugs can even live underground, while snails have to stay on the surface. So one theory is that snails actually came first, and slugs are the adaptation that shed that cumbersome armor rather than slugs slowly evolving the shell for protection.
What do you think?
I think that only snails would leave a fossil record behind, so who knows?
Do you think there are more snails in our region now?
Nah, it may seem that way because it's easier to catch a glimpse of snails during the day, when they essentially just need shade. Most gardeners don't actually see slugs unless they go out and inspect their plants late at night when the slugs are out feeding. Some people are overrun with slugs, but they don't even know it because they only see the damage in the morning.
Which brings us to part two. We also heard from Barbara in Huntington Beach, California, who writes, I have pets and would like to know how to safely rid my garden of snails.
Well, there are 12,000 species of land-dwelling slugs and snails, and one of the most destructive is the brown garden snail, which is the poster child for plant problems in many parts of California. This snail eats gardens to the ground and is even a major pest in orchards. A single tree can have thousands of these snails up in its canopy.
They climb trees?
Oh, yes, they do, and they climb them very well. Orchardists will often have to wrap a band of copper around the trunks of their trees to keep the snails from climbing up, the same way raised bed gardeners use strips of copper around their bed frames to keep snails and slugs out. Slugs and snails won't cross a copper barrier. The metal reacts with their mucus and gives them a kind of electric shock. Another control method that's very safe for pets is the use of beer traps. Small containers baited with fresh beer and left out in the evening. The slugs can't resist the yeast and drowned in the alcohol. yeasty baits that contain iron phosphate, marketed under brand names like Slug-O and Escargot, are also very effective. The slugs go for the yeast, and then they can't metabolize the iron. These products are a great improvement over the old-school slug baits, which contained a highly toxic chemical pesticide. And in certain regions of Southern California, you can buy what are called predatory snails, a species that eats other snails, especially the brown garden snail.
And we can also eat the snails directly, right?
Yes and no. The brown garden snail is the one that is used in French cuisine. In fact, that's how this European native got to be California's biggest garden pest. It escaped from an operation that was raising them for the restaurant market. But culinary snails are bred under very specific conditions and fed special diets to get rid of any toxins, and at least theoretically make them more edible. Although many types of snails are eaten in many parts of the world, some species are poisonous, and I wouldn't eat a strange snail any more than I would an unknown mushroom. But escargot export could become another option for our besieged gardener if she's willing to provide those specialized conditions necessary to make the snails edible. There's now a shortage in France, and some Californians are raising the garden pests for export. Well, that sure was an interesting look at the slimy world of slugs and snails, now wasn't it? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To read it over in detail, with links to lots more information on these miserable mollusks, just click the link for the question of the week at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Gardens Alive supports the You Bet Your Garden question of the week. Yikes, my producer is threatening to feed me to the snails if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time, but you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499 or send us your email and your tired, your poor, your wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org. Please tell us where you live, put the actual subject in the subject line, and check Foist to see if the information you seek is already waiting for you at the Garden Answers A to Z section of our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where you can also listen to the show, download this week's podcast, and follow us on Facebook. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week has been Al Banks. Rich Banowitz and Sarah Kazar, You Bet Your Garden's Internet Illuminati. Our social media director is Amanda McGrath. Check out her fine work at our Facebook page. Our squadron of slime-free soldiers includes editor Al Banks, who recently got nuptialized. Congratulations, Al. Production assistants Jolie Higazi and Cecily Garber. And Alexis Landis, who produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. Just to make things clear, Al is the only one of that bunch who just got married. I'm hard-shelled Mike McGrath, and I'll slither back to see you again next week. Is there a perfect crab apple for making jams and jellies? I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, we'll take a close look at the surprising diversity in this tiny breed of apple. Plus your fabulous phone calls.